I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are coming back to Atlanta right now. Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Welcome to the MLK Tapes, a production of iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the podcast author or individuals participating in the podcast and do not represent those of iHeartMedia, Tenderfoot TV, or their employees. Listener discretion is advised.
To understand the context of this killing, you should understand that Emmett Till, Medgar Evers, four civil rights workers who were buried in a levee were all slain within about 50 or 60 miles of Memphis. Memphis has an interesting reputation of being the first-degree murder capital of America, and in that context, we're not talking about street crime, but organized planned hits. So that explains why this, if you were going to kill somebody, Memphis was the place to do it. And you pull off the killing, and meanwhile, some other folk have done the skullduggery and got some sap set up to take the dive, and 50 years later argue about who did what.
I called the union hall. I said, it's a matter of life and death. I said, I think these people are planning to kill Dr. King.
The authorities would parade, oh, we found a gun that James Earl Ray bought in Birmingham that killed Dr. King. Except, it wasn't the gun that killed Dr. King.
James Earl Ray was a pawn for the official story.
From iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV.
The plan was to get King to the city because they wanted it handled in Memphis where Daddy and them could handle it.
And I have lived with it so long, my children, they scared for me. The Lord told me to not to worry. I've been wanting to tell it all my life.
I'm Bill Klaber, and this is the MLK Tapes. At the top of this episode, we heard Judge Joe Brown speaking at a 2018 symposium at Duquesne University, marking the 50th anniversary of the assassinations of Martin King and Robert Kennedy. Judge Brown had just completed a 15-year run as a judge on a TV reality show. But before that, he had been a real judge in Tennessee and had presided over the last attempt to get James Earl Ray a trial. That case had been brought by Bill Pepper, Ray's attorney at the time, and from the stage of the same symposium, Pepper spoke about Judge Brown and those events of some 20 years before.
We were very pleased to have Judge Brown on the bench because finally there was an impartial, objective, and I might say courageous man up there who was prepared to do what he believed was right. No better expert on ballistics did we find anywhere than Judge Brown.
Judge Brown was indeed an expert when it came to guns. And when he spoke that day on the shooting of King, he focused on Ray's rifle. Was it really the murder weapon? But before we get to forensics, the rates of twists, lands and grooves, and all that, let's hear what Brown had to say about what it was like to be black in Memphis in the bad old days. Joe Brown had a unique perspective because he had not grown up in Tennessee. He had come of age in sunny California, and after law school at UCLA, he accepted a challenging legal fellowship in the nation's heartland. Joe Brown arrived in Memphis in 1973. He noticed the difference right away.
appeared for one of the poverty law centers I was working at with five clients at the local juvenile court. The judge, who had a sixth grade education, he dropped out of the sixth grade, thought I was on his docket, and he called me the N-word. So we had at it, but that was the attitude. And I've actually been in courtrooms in front of a jury, and the judge used the N-word to the jury in describing some of the defendants on trial. So it's not unusual. Now, I also happen to be the first black prosecutor for the city of Memphis, and one of the interesting, rather disgusting charges that I would see on records when I would be asked to make an offer on something was something like this: reckless eyeballing by a colored person. That's a quote on what the charge was. Colored person refusing to remove from sidewalk for passage of white person. This was an interesting one: acting too colored in public. So I would see these kind of charges on people's rap sheets. And that was the atmosphere in the early 1970s. You still had that thing going on.
In describing his shock at landing in what for him was the Wild West, Judge Brown recalled a particular evening in a Memphis courtroom.
Well, we had this old guy, late 80s, maybe early 90s, and he was on the docket. So I asked the judge if I could advance the case since the arresting officer was coming in that evening on a traffic matter. So the judge gave me permission. I got the file jacket brought to the courtroom, and I'm standing around waiting for this case to come up when the back door of the courtroom is kicked in. And he was an old man. He had his model 19357 Smith up in the air. And the many officers in the courtroom, instead of doing what you think they'd do, they all dived under the cover of the pews. So he walked in and he said, "Who the devil, et cetera, et cetera," he was cussing, "put his hands on my nigra. Don't nobody touch my nigras and my hunting animals but me." So he walks up to the cop in question, grabs him by the collar, puts the pistol to his head and said, "I'll blow your brains out, I'll kill you, your scrawny looking wife, all your children, your livestock and your hunting animals, if you ever do this again." So he walks over and, "Shut up, Robert," that was the judge's name, "I used to do your mama. You may be one of mine that I don't know about." So the judge says, "Mr. Brown, what number is he on the docket?" I said, "Your Honor, so show those dismissed." So he walked out of there. I said, "Why did nobody do anything?" He said, "That's Jimmy Thompson. That's death incarnate."
Brown didn't know who Jimmy Thompson was, but during a recess, he was pulled aside by some old-timer who tried to fill him in. Turns out, Jimmy Thompson had, at one time, been sheriff in Memphis for some 16 years.
"This old guy said, let me tell you a story about when I was a young deputy with the sheriff's department before I got on the police department. Said we was out, and you know, we busted couple of good old boys, and they were drunk. And Jimmy Thompson pulled up in his V12 Packard automobile, and he stopped. He came on and say, 'I know this man.' He said, 'He ain't nothing but scum.' He said, 'Who you?' So the guy told him, he said, 'You take care of your wife and children?' He said, 'Well, yes, sir, I try.' He said, 'You just drunk than that, right? Get on up out of here.' He says, 'So I'm wondering what the sheriff's gonna do.' He pulls his revolver out, shoots the other man in the head twice. Said, 'I told this scum he ain't gonna dirty up my jail no more. Call the meat wagon.' So that was my first time meeting the sheriff face to face. He said, 'Jimmy gonna kill 45, 50 people in his career.' So when Jimmy pull out a gun, everybody diving for cover because somebody likely to die. But you see, this is the background in Memphis, Tennessee at this point in time."
Joe Brown would go on to be the first black prosecutor in the city of Memphis. And after that, he began his own law practice. In 1990, he became a criminal court judge in Shelby County, which includes Memphis. In 1994, Bill Pepper brought a lawsuit seeking to reopen the case against James Earl Ray, who at that time had been in prison for 25 years. The case landed in Judge Brown's courtroom, a lucky break for Pepper and Ray, because Brown took an active interest in the cases that came before him.
And I did a lot of trial work, and one of the things that I did was I helped train the capital defense team for the public defender's office, so that wound up getting me involved in 40, 42 first-degree murder cases. They're fascinating. One of the things I learned from trying that kind of case is when you get it, go to the scene, take a look around, and see if what you see on the ground matches the theory. Well, one of the problems that came out when I got the Ray case was that some of the evidence, as far as I was concerned, did not match the circumstances. First off, let's get a clarification in here. The news media likes to put it out, James Earl Ray, the self-confessed killer of Dr. Martin Luther King. Well, that's an error. He never confessed. He always denied it.
This might seem like a strange thing for Judge Brown to say, because in 1969, James Earl Ray did plead guilty to the explicit charge of murdering Dr. Martin Luther King. If you were with us in episode 4, you heard about the strange circumstances under which that plea was made. And as we heard from his first attorney, Art Haynes Jr., Ray always said that he did not shoot King or anyone else that day. So that is what Judge Brown is referring to, the little-known fact that James Earl Ray always said he did not shoot Martin Luther King. Of course, the authorities said that he did, and their best evidence was not the drunk who said he saw Ray running from the scene, but the rifle found on the street, the one Ray had bought just 2 days before. But Judge Brown was far from convinced that this rifle, Ray's rifle, was the actual murder weapon.
The state claimed that its reasonable factual basis was Ray's rifle, a .30-06 caliber Remington 760 Game Master, a pump rifle. The interesting thing is that really went astray at that point because the FBI claimed that they could not make a ballistics match between Ray's rifle and the bullet they pulled out of King's body. They said it was too distorted to test, that is the death slug. However, examining the evidence in the evidence room, it most certainly was not. There was a big brouhaha about me ordering the rifle retested.
In most cases, when you test fire a gun to see if it's the weapon used in a particular murder, you're creating a bullet that can be compared to the death slug. If the markings on the two bullets are a perfect match, you have determined that this gun fired the fatal shot, to the exclusion of all other guns in the universe. Very often, the match is less than perfect. In this case, if the class characteristics are the same, like the caliber of bullet, you have determined that the weapon tested could have fired the bullet. And that's the best the FBI could do. In essence, King was killed with a .30 caliber bullet, and Ray's rifle could fire a .30 caliber bullet. So what did Judge Brown discover about the rifle and the bullet when this case landed in his courtroom?
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You recognize that weapon?
Yes, that's the 7.60 Game Master in evidence in this case.
Did you have occasion to consider this weapon as the murder weapon in this case? With some degree of depth and careful consideration.
I did, sir.
And when was that?
That was during the course of proceedings brought by the late James Earl Ray in what is known as a post-conviction relief proceeding to challenge his conviction.
You're listening to Judge Joe Brown testify at the 1999 civil trial. Brown, a few years earlier, had presided over the lawsuit seeking to reopen the case against James Earl Ray. The man asking the questions is Bill Pepper, who at the civil trial is representing the King family.
Now, Judge Brown, how long did you preside over those proceedings?
I'd like to say about 3 years. It all sort of shifts into a blur. It got in my courtroom. There was, at that time, a set of laws and cases that had been decided that basically caused me to deny the petition of James Earl Ray. So what I ordered was that the petition would be denied, but I would allow the petitioner to put on what is known as a proffer of proof. In other words, if he were allowed to present this evidence, this is what it would show, so an appellate court could determine whether or not the law needed to be reviewed. Well, in any event, I ordered that the rifle be retested. It went to the Court of Criminal Appeals, who went along with the prosecutorial side of things and declined to allow that rifle to be retested and issued a stay.
The blur that Judge Brown just mentioned has to do with the fact that the Ray case in his court dragged on for the better part of 3 years, 1994 to 1997. It was a legal battle over whether Ray would have the right to present evidence that might overturn his conviction, even though the statute of limitations for doing such a thing had long ago run out. There were orders, stays, appeals, changes in state law, more stays. Most of the time was spent waiting around for a ruling on some appeal of a ruling made in Judge Brown's court. It was a frustrating, messy affair that defies any simple description. But we will touch on some of the important points. As Judge Brown said, the Court of Appeals initially prevented him from ordering a test firing of the rifle, but it didn't prevent him from going through the case files. Sometime in 1996, he had the death slug fragments put under a high-powered electron microscope. When he did this, sure enough, the rifling had a right-hand twist, just as the FBI said. But as he told the court that day, there was something else, something that required a little high school trigonometry.
It appears that the death slug that was taken out of King's body was fired from a rifle that had a rate of rifling twist of one turn in every 11 and a quarter inches. Ray's rifle, for those who are interested, had a rate of rifling twist of one turn in 10 inches. If you've got an 11 and a quarter inch rate of rifling twist, you're talking custom barrel. And James Earl Ray, I assure you, had no access to anybody making custom barrels at that time.
If Judge Brown's calculations are correct, and you could get the case back in court, it would go a long way to proving that Ray's rifle was not the murder weapon. More certain still, Judge Brown's poking around like that was beginning to make people uncomfortable. Most judges don't use microscopes to look at bullets. Most judges don't think in terms of metallurgy or rates of twist. But Judge Brown did, and the pressure to relieve him of his duties increased. And strange things were starting to happen. Judge Brown told me of several incidents. In one, in 1996 or 97, his house was invaded by men wearing ski masks. He had gotten home late, fallen asleep at the kitchen table, and then woke up.
I heard some noise, and I was sitting in my kitchen, and I became aware of some shadows out back and some out front. And to make a long story short, two people tried to break in the front, three in the back at the same time. They jimmied the screens out of the windows and took glass cutters to cut the pane out so they could open the windows. They were dressed in pretty much the same thing, dark clothing, balaclavas with just the eyes out. And apparently they had on some heavy Kevlar armor and they had sidearms on the side. I was thinking, why are the police raiding me? And then I said, these aren't police. I'm a sitting judge. This is 3:30 a.m. in the morning. And they came in and there was a shootout. I wound up having to patch the walls. I called my friend Winfrey, who was the director of the police at that time. He came out. We looked around. We found some blood trails out front, out back, and there was no report of anyone being treated in an emergency room and no reports of this incident. So that's a little wild, but actually, my disposition, I found it intriguing.
Intriguing or not, according to Judge Brown, nothing ever came of that incident. But one afternoon, not long after that, Brown said he got a phone call while he was in court.
What's going on, Judge? This is Detective so-and-so. We're out in the parking lot. Somebody's trying to break in your Lexus. Okay. 5 minutes later, Judge, so-and-so, they were trying to plant 2 kilos of coke in your car. Oh, wow. All right. We got them. What's going on? They say they were with a federal agency and they made a mistake during this sting, but your name's on your parking place, you know, stuff like that.
It's hard to know just what to make of such stories, but Judge Brown feels they were related to his handling of the Ray case. And things were starting to heat up because although he had initially been prevented from having the rifle test fired, Judge Brown finally won permission to do that very thing. The rifle was tested by ballistics expert Robert Hathaway at the University of Rhode Island Crime Lab. And 2 weeks later, the results were revealed in court.
After hearing testimony from ballistics experts, Memphis Judge Joe Brown decided further examination of test fire bullets from James Earl Ray's rifle may be needed.
This was one headline the day after the test results of the rifle were announced. Hathaway testified that he fired and recovered 18 bullets like the one that killed Dr. King. 12 of those 18 emerged with unique markings matching them to each other and to the rifle itself, but they didn't match the fatal slug recovered from Dr. King. But 6 bullets did not have those particular markings even though they were fired from the same weapon. Hathaway's tests strongly suggested that the death slug was not fired from Ray's rifle, but it was short of proving that. If 6 bullets could have been fired by the rifle but not be with certainty traced back to it, then the same could be true for the death slug. There was immediate talk of a retest.
More scientific tests may be conducted on James Earl Ray's rifle to see if it was used to kill Martin Luther King. Tests described Friday were inconclusive, though a buildup of material in the rifle barrel could be to blame.
But today, experts told Judge Joe Brown, James Earl Ray's rifle had not been thoroughly cleaned since the last test firing, and that buildup within the barrel may have jeopardized the accuracy of this testing.
As soon as the results of the rifle test were announced, Bill Pepper asked for the rifle to be tested again. Judge Brown then asked the appeals court for permission to retest the gun after it had been cleaned.
What we wanted was to get everything out so we could get a pristine bore and get the best sample possible. There's a company called Outers, and they make cleaning supplies for weapons. They had a reverse plating device known as a foul out. And what you do is when you hook the weapon's rifle up to this, you get an electric current going, which causes any fouling in the bore to come out without having to scrub it.
But the authorities were not keen on this proposal.
State witness Tommy Heflin of the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation testified cleaning the rifle may damage it and could alter the markings on the bullets when fired.
So you're going to change and either take away or you're going to add things to it.
They had the idea that what you're going to do is take a wire brush and run it up and down the bore, and they were worried about that damaging the rifle. They had a very peculiar thing that they put in their documentation. The state said, if the rifle is tested at this point, it may become damaged, which would, quote, prevent it from being retested in the future, unquote. Now, that one eludes me. If you don't want it tested now, why do you want it tested in the future?
As it turned out, Judge Brown never got permission to test the rifle again. And what finally happened to Ray's appeal? Here is Judge Brown's response to that very question asked by Bill Pepper at the civil trial in 1999.
Well, they removed me from the case. They said I was biased toward James Earl Ray, which I found rather astonishing. If anybody knows me, me being biased in favor of a self-avowed racist and bigot is just absolutely disgusting as a concept. But what I've always tried to do is be fair, impartial, neutral, and detached straight down the middle. And sometimes or another, that upsets people when things don't go as they expect them to go.
So you were removed from the case by whom?
Tennessee Court of Criminal Appeals.
So Judge Brown was removed, and another judge was brought in, and Ray's petition for post-conviction relief was dismissed. But the mysteries surrounding Ray's rifle have only deepened. Anyone today who looks into the case can learn soon enough that the FBI could not match the death slug to Ray's rifle. But at the time of the murder and Ray's subsequent plea hearing a year later, the common wisdom in the country was that a match had been made. How had this come about?
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To to Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It is incumbent upon the state, in a plea of guilty to murder in the first degree, to put on certain proof for your consideration. We have to put on proof of what we lawyers call the proof of corpus delicti, which is the body of the crime.
This is a reading of the words of Assistant Attorney General James Beasley, spoken at Ray's plea hearing in March 1968. In Tennessee at the time, after a person had pleaded guilty to murder, the state was obligated to present some of the evidence they would have offered had there been a trial. So the state put on an abbreviated and uncontested version of their case. They called witnesses who saw Dr. King brought down by a bullet. They introduced a doctor who said that Dr. King died because of that bullet, and a police officer who found a .30-caliber rifle on the street. Beasley then spoke of an expert who would testify that he discovered the fingerprints of James Earl Ray on that rifle. And then the clincher. Assistant AG Beasley spoke of an FBI man who would testify at the trial, had there been one, as to his examination of the death slug and its relationship to the found rifle.
He examined the cartridges, the hole from the chamber of this rifle, the slug removed from the body of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and would testify to his conclusions as follows. The death slug was identical in all physical characteristics with the five loaded .30-06 Springfield cartridges found in the bag in front of Knipes. The cartridge case had in fact been fired in this .30-06 rifle. That the death slug removed from the body contained land and groove impressions and direction of twist consistent with those that were in the barrel of this rifle.
To the jurors and the newsmen in the room, it seemed that nothing more needed to be said. But Mark Lane, who would be Ray's attorney 8 years later, said the following about what had happened in his book Murder in Memphis. Quote, "The veteran lawyers in the courtroom smiled to themselves in much the same way as professional magicians might do when they observe an audience puzzled by a simple but well-performed trick." So what was the trick? All the fancy talk of direction of twist and land and grooves impressions being consistent with the barrel of Ray's rifle didn't mean that the bullet had been matched to the rifle. It only meant that Ray's rifle could have fired that bullet, along with thousands of other .30-caliber rifles. But to the newsmen present and the American people who would read their stories, the case was a slam dunk. Not only had Ray entered a guilty plea, the police had found his rifle and determined that it was the gun that killed King. But just below the surface, practically in plain sight, was a much more troubling problem about the attempt to match the death slug to the gun purchased by James Earl Ray. But as simple as it was, it took 25 years for it to raise its ugly head.
Captain, do you recognize this photograph?
I recognize the body. I recognize a bullet that was there as being a photograph that I took at the morgue of Dr. Martin Luther King.
This audio comes from the 1993 HBO trial. Bill Pepper is cross-examining Captain Tommy Smith, who was a Memphis police lieutenant at the time of the murder. Off to the side, next to where Pepper is standing, Dr. King's lifeless back is displayed on a screen. Attorney Pepper gestures toward the image.
When you're pointing to the bullet, are you indicating this lump here?
Yes, sir.
Dr. King's back?
That's correct.
By his shoulder blade area. Did you attempt to determine from outside the skin, the structure of that bullet under the skin?
Yes, sir, I did. And you could take your finger and pinch and feel and roll that bullet under the skin.
But did you do that?
I did.
And what did you feel as you pinched and rolled?
I felt a very good bullet and was very thankful that we had a bullet to compare.
And was it in one piece and intact?
What I could feel was in one piece.
In preparing for the televised mock trial, Pepper had discovered the photograph of King's back in the police files. When he found out who had taken it, he contacted Captain Smith, who agreed to testify as to what he had seen that night. And if Smith were correct, if the lump under the skin was indeed the death slug, and if it were in such good condition that it could roll around under the skin, at what point in time did it become the three grossly misshapen pieces of lead, which is what we have of the fatal bullet today? It's a valid question, and one without a good answer. The problem for Pepper was that although Smith had touched the object under the skin and rolled it around with his finger, he had not actually seen the bullet removed. But then Pepper discovered a man who was said to have seen the bullet taken from King's body. It was retired homicide detective Barry Linville, who lived some distance outside of Memphis. Pepper called Detective Linville and asked if he could come by with a few questions about the King murder. When Pepper arrived, Linville asserted that he had indeed been in the autopsy room and that he had seen the death slug removed from Dr. King's shoulder. Pepper then showed Linville the FBI photo of the three bullet fragments said to be what remained of the death slug. Linville was stunned, because the fragments in the photo in no way resembled what he saw in the morgue. Detective Linville could not be compelled to appear at the HBO trial. He could have stayed out of it, but he was so disturbed by what he saw, he agreed to testify, where he was questioned by Bill Pepper.
And were you present when the body was received at the morgue and in Dr. Francisco's presence?
Yes.
And would you describe what happened at that point?
We examined the wound, and then when we turned the body over, we could see the bullet underneath the skin on the left shoulder.
Were you present when that bullet was removed?
Yes, I was.
And how was that done?
With a scalpel.
And who did that?
Dr. Francisco.
You observed Dr. Francisco remove the bullet?
I did.
The death slug?
Yes.
Would you describe this bullet?
Appeared to be a .30-06 caliber. The entire copper jacket was intact, and the end of the bullet was flattened out, the lid. At the end of a .30-06, it's got about approximately a quarter of an inch of lead, and it was flattened out, but the copper was all intact and showed excellent lens and grooves in it.
How many bullets would you say you have seen in your homicide career?
Thousands.
And in terms of the physical condition of this bullet, how would you rate it?
I'd rate it on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd rate it 9.
Intact?
Intact.
Pepper then displayed the official FBI photo of the death slug in three fragments.
Do you see these three fragments on the screen?
Yes.
These have been introduced as the death slug in this case. Is this the bullet you saw?
No.
Does it resemble the bullet you saw in any way?
No.
I have no further questions for this witness.
Prosecutor Hickman Ewing rose and began his cross-examination. Linville's story of seeing a near-perfect bullet removed from King's back presented serious problems. Problems that had never been explored before, because for 25 years, the death slug had been represented by three very distorted pieces of lead. How could that be if the actual bullet had emerged intact? Ewing questioned Linville, but his story remained the same. Ewing then had Linville come down from the witness stand and draw on an easel a rough picture of the bullet he had seen removed from King's body. The bullet he drew was in one piece and perfectly shaped, except for some flattening on the tip. Ewing was stumped.
You're saying what you all saw taken out of Dr. King looked like that?
Yes.
It was perfect in every manner?
Yeah, except right up here. We felt like we'd found a piece of gold when we found the bullet.
Have you been asked about this over the last 25 years? Is this the first time a week ago that you
were asked? The first time I've been asked about the bullet.
Ever?
Ever.
Linville said to Ewing that when they discovered the fatal bullet in near pristine condition, they felt like they had found a piece of gold. He meant that a death slug in such good condition carries a lot of information that can be very useful in solving a crime. In this case, such a bullet might well have proved without a doubt that it had been fired by Ray's rifle as the district attorney said it was. Or it might have proved that Ray's gun had not fired this bullet. This is a strange conflict to discover 25 years after an important murder regarding the most critical piece of physical evidence. Prosecutor Ewing couldn't really argue with Linville about what he said he saw. He wasn't there. Linville was. But he could challenge his testimony in another way. When ballistics expert Charles Morton took the stand, Ewing pointed to the images of the three pieces of lead shown in the FBI photograph.
And then you've got these little pieces here. How much would you say that would weigh?
Well, I'm at an advantage. I read the report that says it's 64 grains, which is a little bit less than half of the weight.
You're saying a perfect bullet, it's 150 grains, and this weighed 64.4 grains.
Right.
Ewing then wrote the numbers 150 and 64 side by side on an easel with Linville's drawing of the bullet to make his point. The bullet fragments weighed less than half of what Linville said he saw. Ewing may have felt as though he had damaged Linville's assertion of an intact bullet, but to the jurors, who would ultimately find Ray not guilty, the large difference in appearance and weight may well have made them feel that something was very wrong. Assuming that Officer Smith and Detective Linville are telling the truth, and I can think of no reason for them to lie, we are presented with two possibilities. The first is that something happened to the evidence bullet, some handling or mishandling, to make it look like it does today. But how are there no records of this? And how does a found bullet lose more than half its weight? The other possibility is that the bullet seen by Linville was discarded, and the mangled lead we see today was put in its place. I don't know the answer here, and this may be a bigger leap than some of you are willing to make. But for context, I can say that I studied the Robert Kennedy murder for years. I wrote a book about it. And what I can tell you to a certainty is that the police lied about the bullet evidence they recovered, and when that lie was about to be exposed, they destroyed the evidence itself. Again, I don't know what happened to the bullet in the King case, but when you are looking at evidence presented by the authorities, you might do well to remember the song, "It Ain't Necessarily So." Also, I invite you to go to our website and look at the photograph of the death slug fragments posted alongside the drawing of the evidence bullet made by Detective Linville. The explanation for the difference may be innocent, or it may be nefarious, but whatever it is, this is one hell of an alteration of a prime piece of evidence. A problem with a bullet might also be a reason why there was such pressure on Ray to plead guilty. For if Ray had a trial and an attorney serving his interests, that attorney may well have discovered the conflict. He would have been able to put others on the witness stand who had been at the morgue and had seen what Detective Linville and Smith testified to. He could have demanded to see documents and photos in the police and FBI files. He could have asked a jury, how was it that a bullet that might well have proved his client's innocence could end up as three pieces of tortured lead? Looking back from a distance of 50 years, it is hard for us to sort it out with certainty, but it might have been a very different story at Ray's trial, if he'd had one.
Next time on the MLK Tapes.
Memphis had taken a lot of pride in itself. It was paternalistic. They had made some gains, but it was racist to the culture.
They had a list that the Ku Klux Klan and Citizen Council passed around. And the list contained names they called the troublemakers with X's behind it.
The plan was to get King to the city because they wanted it handled in Memphis where Daddy and them could handle it.
He told me, he said, I didn't kill the but I had it done. And I said, well, what about that other son of a bitch up there taking credit for it? And he says, he wasn't nothing but a troublemaker from Missouri. He was a front man.
Last Wednesday morning, the FBI told me they didn't believe this story related in any way to the King's assassin, and they were through with it.
He said they wouldn't be there. They wouldn't be there that night.
Did he say there would be a decoy there?
Yes. Said it would be set up or look like someone else done the killing.
Thanks for listening to the MLK Tapes, a production of iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV.
This podcast is not specifically endorsed by the King family or the King estate. The MLK Tapes is written and hosted by Bill Klaber. Matt Frederick and Alex Williams are executive producers on behalf of iHeartRadio, with producers Trevor Young and Ben Kiebrick. Donald Albright and Payne Lindsay are executive producers on behalf of Tenderfoot TV, with producers Jamie Albright and Meredith Stedman. Original music by Makeup and Vanity Set. Cover art by Mr. Soul 216, with photography by Artemis Jenkins. Special thanks to Owen Rosenbaum and Grace Royer at UTA, The Nord Group, Beck Media and Marketing, Envision Business Management, and Station 16. If you have questions, you can visit our website, themlktapes.com. We posted photos and videos related to the podcast on our social media accounts. You can check them out at themlktapes. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV, please visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are coming back to Atlanta right now. Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.